Slate spoiler specials are brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free audiobook when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/spoiler.
Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on Muppets Most Wanted, the new sequel, part two of the new rebooted franchise of The Muppets. And joining me to talk about it is our resident Muppet expert, as I think of you, John Swansburg. Definitely resident Muppet enthusiast, anyway.
I'm definitely an enthusiast. I don't know if I know enough to be considered an expert, but for these purposes, I'm happy to play that role.
And you are also Slate's editorial director.
Correct.
And also, you've got some recent Muppet background because you just reviewed a big biography, the big new biography of Jim Henson, right?
Yeah,
New York Times.
That was really fun, and it was an excuse to go back and rewatch like probably way more Muppet movies and television shows than was strictly necessary for the purposes of writing that 800-word review.
Yeah, that is a great excuse. So
yes,
you're steeped in Muppet lore right now.
I am, yes. I've watched Labyrinth recently. Which probably most people can't say. Most people of my age probably can't say that.
Most people who can say that are actually working on a felt puppet right now. They have one on their hand.
Exactly.
So Muppets Most Wanted, you liked this better than I did. We haven't really talked about it yet. We saw it together but didn't meet up after the screening.
Right.
So as you know from my review now, I was sadly not a fan. I really wanted to like this. I mean, I brought so much goodwill in because I just love the Muppets, really liked the last movie. It was sort of a silly reboot, but it was such a sweet-spirited one that I sort of felt like they got the Muppets.
Yeah.
And I deeply feel that The Muppets Most Wanted does not get The Muppets. And so I want to get at why you think it does, or at least you're willing to accept its flaws more.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I left the movie thinking, oh, that was fun. It wasn't as good as the previous Muppet movie to my mind, but I enjoyed it. It felt a little like longer than it needed to be. It felt particularly slack in the second half. But I left like a pretty happy Muppet camper. And then I edited your review. And afterwards, I was like, wow, Dana kind of convinced me that I didn't like it as much as I thought I did. I mean, I thought you made a lot of good points about what it missed about the Muppets. But I don't know. I mean, part of it for me is I enjoy being in the Muppets company. I feel like the people behind the Muppets reboot do, to some extent, get what is pleasant about and fun about the Muppets. I like that this was a caper. I feel like a caper is a great old Muppet form, and it allows it's a fun setup, plot setup for the kind of hijinks that the Muppets excel at. I thought the music was good, although not as great as the previous one. And to me, the music problem was that there was no breakout song. There's no song I could imagine myself actually singing, you know, outside the context of being in a Muppet movie.
We should say that the music is by Brett McKenzie, the
right.
Flight of the Conchords guy, who also did the music for the first movie. The team is almost identical to the team of the first movie, directed by James Bobin, co-written by the director and Nicholas Stoller, who co-wrote the first movie in this franchise reboot with Jason Segel, and the music by Brett McKenzie. And so I feel like all those people who got it the first time are still there. I wouldn't even quite say that this movie sells out the Muppets or makes them tawdry or something like that. It just doesn't give us enough of what we want from them.
I mean, to me, I think part of it was that when I watched the 2011 movie, it had been so long since there'd been a major Muppet production that I think I was just really starved for Muppets. Like, I think that the first movie benefited a lot from going in, having not seen a Muppet movie for a really long time, liking the Muppets to begin with, and then feeling like, oh, wow, like I'm in the hands of people who really love this form of storytelling and this puppetry, and they've executed it well. And like this is great. It feels like going home again and having an enjoyable experience. And now going back to see another iteration of that, a mere 3 years later, I feel like, you know, with a bar set relatively high, it was, you know, it was bound to be something of a disappointment.
But here's my question: if this had been that 2011 movie, would you have had that same feeling? Would the nostalgia alone and the love for the Muppets alone have been enough to elevate this movie?
That's a great question. I think probably not, and in part for I think you made a really good point in your review that crystallized something that I don't think I'd quite figured out on my own. But, you know, we haven't talked much about the plot, but the plot of this film involves there being a kind of evil Kermit twin named Constantine, who's a Russian frog, and who's also a criminal mastermind, like the number one thief in the world. And he's, when we first meet him, he's in a Russian gulag, but he escapes and ultimately switches places with Kermit. And so a lot of this movie is actually focused on this new evil frog, Constantine, not on good old Kermit, who I think we all love spending time with. And I think that was a big problem for this movie. Like, there's just a lot of time spent with this new evil frog who's like kind of a one-note joke, and Kermit's kind of off in the gulag doing his own thing, which is pleasant enough, but you don't have that whole sort of like gang getting back together sort of vibe that animated so many of the previous movies.
Right. I mean, because they strand Kermit, because the filmmakers choose to strand Kermit in this gulag, which I will say, I like the scenes with Kermit in the gulag, with Tina Fey as this guard, the Russian prison guard who's secretly in love with him. That stuff is funny.
You like that more than I did. I thought that stuff was okay, but it was just like, it required a lot of Tina Fey and Kermit. Like, that was what they had one, like, I thought they had one good scene and one good number, but then when the movie would shift back there, I was sort of like, okay, like, more of this. He's obviously going to escape at some point. He's obviously going to, like, train the other members, human members of the gulag, get to do some kind of funny song and dance number. It all felt kind of like scripted ahead, and I wasn't particularly excited to see how it would be executed. I just wanted Kermit to get back to the
gang. No, it's a static choice to strand him there at the gulag. Those scenes are good, but they're static, and they don't bring us the thing that we want, which, as you say, is Kermit and the Muppets together doing their own caper, having their own adventure of some kind. Instead, it was just a strange story decision that at some point they just said, let's make, I don't know, three quarters of the scene be about the relationship between Ricky Gervais, who is the right-hand man of the villain, right? He's the Muppets' evil manager who's secretly in cahoots with Constantine, and this Russian frog who's pretending to be Kermit. I mean, neither of those are really Muppets. I mean, they're not the Muppets that we know and care about. Also, I mean, they're both villains who don't change at all. It's not like, you know, they're the Grinch or some sort of complex character who sort of either their heart grows at the end or, you know, you discover something about the root of their evil. No, they're just kind of flat bad guys who remain flat the entire time.
It's a great point. And we don't spend that much time with any of the other Muppets. All the other Muppets have relatively small screen time. It's like Scooter has a line here, Fozzie has a line there. You know, there's actually one of the characters, Muppet characters you spend the most time with is what I would say the worst Muppet, this guy Walter, who was essentially created for the previous movie and sort of made sense in the context of the previous movie. It was a kind of funny conceit, like, oh, here's a Muppet living in the human world needing to find the Muppets. Like, that worked. But, like, Walter's kind of like a milquetoast little puppet. Like, no one cares about him, I think, outside of the context of that.
There's even a joke about that in the movie at one point, right?
Oh,
there's some sort of – among the Muppets, there's some sort of joke about some people think too much attention has been paid to Walter.
Oh, I thought that joke was about just like how those Muppets – that's spoken by one of the rats from Muppets Take Manhattan. I think it's Rizzo, the rat. And I thought that was just a joke about how he felt like he had been given short shrift, not necessarily because of Walter, but maybe the subtext was that Rizzo was upset, particularly with Walter.
I think that was one of the few callbacks to the previous movie. I mean, that story world that was established in the last movie with Jason Segel and Amy Adams falling in love and, you know, Walter being their friend is completely gone. It might as well have never happened, right? When it comes to this movie, this is kind of a standalone caper, as you say. So, okay. So we've established that the villains are kind of dull. What are some things that you liked about this movie? Musically,
as I said before, I did like it. I feel like Brett McKenzie is the perfect talent to pair with the Muppets. I think he gets what makes Muppet songs fun. He's such a genius for pastiche, for creating different kinds of songs for different occasions. My favorite song was a kind of like a disco number that Constantine, the evil frog, sings when he's trying to woo Miss Piggy. And it just sort of like it has funny lyrics. It sort of takes on this kind of weird 70s disco vibe, but it does it in a really like authentic sounding way. But again, I think the previous movie had Am I a Man or a Muppet, which was an Oscar nominated song that I felt like that was a song you heard it in the movie. You're like, that's actually going to be something people talk about outside of the context of this movie, or at least it's going to break out of the movie. Everything here felt sort of like it was a musical dramatization of some plot point in the movie. And I didn't – while I was like happy to tap my toe to it, I wasn't like, oh, this is going to be a great song that people talk about.
And the whole movie, I think, had that feeling. It was functional. It had a certain kind of functionality. There didn't seem like there were many moments of spontaneity or excess or just something that was thrown in because it was so crazy and fun that they couldn't resist it.
Right. And I think another issue – I mean, you asked me about what I liked about it, and I keep coming up with things that I didn't like about it. But another thing that bothered you and did bother me a bit is that there's just a tremendous parade of cameos in the movie. And I think historically, cameos have been a really fun part of the whole Muppets endeavor. Like, you know, seeing who would be the star of the Muppet Show in a given week during the television show's run was really fun. You know, it could be anyone from Johnny Cash to Candace Bergen to the cast of Star Wars. And seeing how different humans interacted with the puppets was always part of the pleasure. But here, and I'm basically stealing your idea, but like here the – the humans were sort of like, oh, it was more like, look who we got to do a scene with the Muppets. They flash on the screen, and it's almost like a game of, like, can you spot the cameo? They're there for a second, then they're gone. And a lot of them didn't even really interact with the puppets. It's like, oh, there's Lady Gaga. Oh, and then she's gone. Like, oh, there's, you know, there's Usher. That Usher was actually kind of a funny joke because Usher shows up playing an Usher at a wedding. But that was like a – but that's like the nature of it. It's like a one-note joke, right? It's like Usher doesn't really have any chance to interact with the puppets. And that's a lot of where the magic happens, I think, in the Muppets, is the interplay.
Right. I mean, both in Sesame Street and in the Muppet Show, it was sort of all about a human standing next to a Muppet and them having some sort of interaction. Obviously, the last movie as well, since it was about Walter learning to become a Muppet rather than a human, was also about that discord between the flesh and blood figure and the felt and cloth figure.
Right.
But if you don't play on that, then what is the point? That was especially true of the Celine Dion cameo, where she shows up with Miss Piggy to sing this kind of power ballad about lost love when Miss Piggy is pining away for who she thinks is Kermit, but is, of course, actually Constantine.
Right.
But Celine Dion not only didn't interact with Miss Piggy, she just didn't seem to be in the same space as her. You just had the feeling that Celine Dion was in front of a green screen in Vegas after her show, quickly taping this portion of a song for the Muppets. It didn't give a feeling that she was doing anything other than lending her brand name to the show.
Yeah, I agree.
So let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor. The Spoiler Special is delighted to be sponsored by Audible.com, the leading provider of premium digital spoken audio entertainment on the web. They have more than 100,000 audiobooks, which you can play on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on now, and they have a special offer for Spoiler listeners. You can get a 30-day free trial and one free book by signing up here, audiblepodcast.com/spoiler. So you can choose your free book there, and they have tons of choices, as I say, but we like to recommend something that's related in some way to the topic of our podcast, and it so happens that we have an excellent, excellent Audible plug this week. John, do you want to take it away?
Sure. Well, the book that I reviewed about Jim Henson is available on Audible. It's by Brian J. Jones, and it's a truly engrossing biography. Jim Henson was just such a remarkable talent. I think anyone who's a fan of the Muppets or Sesame Street sort of knows that, but I, for one, did not appreciate the degree to which Henson was a true genius and a pioneer, and also a very savvy business mind as well, which is something I certainly didn't understand before reading this book. And so if you're even a casual Muppet fan, I think it's a really fun read, and it's an inspiring one. I mean, just Henson's one of those talents who you learn about, and it just makes you sort of feel in awe of his abilities and the energy and joy that he brought to his work. It makes you really inspired.
Yeah, I really wanted to read that when I read your review of it. And every time I see the Muppets, it makes me miss him. I feel like, you know, of course, it's hard not to be nostalgic and think if he were still around, you know, what would the Muppet franchise be like and what would not be allowed to happen?
Sure.
So to find Brian J. Jones' wonderful biography of Jim Henson and 100,000 other books, you can go again to audiblepodcast.com/spoiler. The Spoiler Special thanks Audible for their support. All right, John, back to Muppets Most Wanted. Your job here was supposed to be to defend this movie, but you seem to be getting swayed over to the dark side of believing that it's a betrayal of the
Muppets. You ruined this movie for me, Dana. I know you're so persuasive. But no, I did really enjoy it, and I'm not doing a very good job of explaining why. I mean, one thing that's tricky is that there are a lot of, as is the case with lots of Muppet things, there's a lot of great gags, like sort of individual moments that made me laugh. Particularly in the beginning of the movie, I felt like there was a good pace of just jokes that were classic kind of Muppet jokes or just really well executed. And one that really stuck in my mind, and I don't know if it'll sound funny when described, but it's really great when you see the movie, is that they have this opening number. It's very meta. The movie begins the moment that the previous movie has ended, and they break into this big musical number about how they want to do a sequel right away. And so they're singing about doing a sequel, and they're tossing out as part of the song various ideas for what the new movie could be. And you kind of see little visions of different pitches made by different Muppets, and one of them is the screen flashes to black and white, and you see the figure of Death holding his scythe, sitting next to a chessboard, and across from him is the Swedish Chef, and it's obviously the idea is that you would be a Muppet version of the Seventh Seal, which
I agree that was a great
which
gag.
Is like, you know, you did not see that coming at all. Obviously, making the Swedish Chef being the one who's in that shot is just I've always thought the Swedish Chef is the funniest Muppet, but that was like truly like a laugh out loud moment for me. Did not see it coming, and a great just like, you know, classic Muppet nod to other, you know, to the history of art. That said, like, that's obviously a very sophisticated joke. It's not one that, you know, if your daughter was watching that movie, like, would she get like a Ingmar Bergman joke? Probably not. Of course, the Muppets always are nodding to the adult world and the children's world at the same time. Although one thing that struck me about this movie was that a lot of the material here seemed to kind of peg more to adults than to children. And this is something that actually Neil Gensler mentioned in his New York Times review. But like there's this whole subplot involving a sort of like Inspector Clouseau type investigator played by Ty Burrell. He's an Interpol guy trying to find Constantine alongside Sam the Eagle. And that whole plot is sort of predicated on a series of jokes about how lazy Europeans are and how long their lunch breaks are. And like, I don't know. I mean, do like little kids care about European, you know, fecklessness? Like, I don't know. It doesn't. That seems like a weird thing to keep to harp on for what's ostensibly still a kid's franchise.
Yeah, I thought about my kid during this and whether she would like the movie. I think she would enjoy it some basic level that there were fun Muppets doing stuff and that there were catchy songs, but I don't think she would follow or care about really any of the stories at all. I mean, the gulag stuff, she would probably enjoy that because of the songs and dances again, but you know, all the kind of prison break jokes and all of those references would go completely over her head. I don't think anyone in their right mind would enjoy the Ricky Gervais Constantine relationship, which I just really feel drags down the whole center of the movie. And then there's this also very adult component to the Miss Piggy Kermit relationship in this movie, which, you know, I guess if you were sort of a shipper for Piggy and Kermit, it would be really exciting because you kind of delve into their domestic squabbles and her doubts and his doubts about marriage, but it just doesn't seem to fit again with the Muppets universe at all.
Yeah, and as you pointed out in your review, I feel like the Piggy-Kermit relationship has always been a great will-they-won't-they, but you don't want it to ever go farther than that. It's not like Ross and Rachel, like, all right, just get together already. You always want Kermit and Miss Piggy to be suspended in this state of almost maybe getting together and Piggy really wanting it and Kermit not being sure. But there's actually a number, a song and dance number towards the end of the movie where we see a vision of a happily married Kermit and Piggy that involves actually seeing their offspring in this way that's like, A, it makes you think much more in a much more detailed way than you ever wanted to about like how sex between a frog and a pig would work. And B, it shows you a like this kind of weird offspring where it's like, what, it's like a pink frog and a green pig lit.
Yeah, they're like mutant babies in a stroller.
Like, yeah, like do you want to explain that to your kids? Like any more so than you want to explain what a gulag is? I don't know. I wouldn't. I'm not a parent, but it seems like you'd walk out of that movie with a lot of difficult questions to answer.
You also see them old, which makes you wonder why have none of the Muppets aged so far in the 30 years they've existed?
It's true. Although it was kind of fun seeing them old, like seeing just like they put little bags under Kermit's eye. You know, Kermit is such a simple puppet. I think that's one of the reasons he's so beloved. That's actually something that Brian J. Jones writes about in his Henson book that I'd never quite considered, but I think is a really powerful point, that Kermit is the simplest puppet, but it also made him the most expressive.
Right, like, he's like a green sock, basically.
He's basically like a green piece of felt with a halved ping pong ball for eyes, and particularly when Henson would manipulate him, and Henson almost always did, he could make Kermit have so many different expressions, much more so than Piggy. Like, Piggy's like a giant structure. Her like head is like architectural. You know, she kind of does everything with
right.
With
so the
her
hand
snout.
Is pretty far from the actual face, right? There's
exactly.
All this foam in between,
right? So Kermit is I think one reason we love him so much is he's the most expressive of the puppets. And so it was fun seeing just like they added some bags to his under his ping pong ball eyes. He just all of a sudden looked older. It was kind of a nice bit of sort of puppetry magic. But I agree, it's sort of disconcerting to think that Kermit isn't, you know, perpetually 35. I don't know what this Kermit. I don't know. It's a good question, actually.
Whose brain was that supposed to be in? I can't remember now. Like, who was imagining the future happiness montage of Piggy and Kermit?
That's great. I mean, that's a great question. I guess Piggy? I don't know. I can't remember now. Doesn't speak well of the movie that we can't neither
yeah,
of us
the
can
song kind
that.
Of all blend together. But at that point, they do at least at the end occupy the same space. I mean, but by the time Kermit meets up with the rest of the Muppets, I feel like the story has become so heist-centric that it really isn't about them putting on a show. This is one more criticism, and then we can wrap up, and maybe you can say one last nice thing on behalf of the Muppets Most Wanted. But is that there's not a real putting on a show kind of element. Like, there's something a little bit depressing about how slipshod this vaudeville tour of Europe is that is going on in the background of this movie, right? Gervais
right.
orchestrates this tour of all the great cities of Europe, but he's also paying off audiences to come and give a standing ovation.
Right.
I don't know. There's something about the lack of stakes for that show that also seemed very un-Muppet-like.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think it gets back to the earlier criticism of separating Kermit from the rest of the gang. I mean, so much of the previous Muppet plots have been about, you know, Kermit's ability to channel an actually good performance from this anarchic crew of crazies, you know, and that doesn't really quite happen here. As you say, like, the show there's a little bit of a subplot about how about like I guess we see what would happen without Kermit, right?
It's right.
Like without Kermit there to you know tell Gonzo that the running of the bulls on stage is not a good idea, or that you know Piggy can't do an 18-minute montage you know song, that the show would stink. But we never actually get – they don't – there isn't a moment where we get to – Kermit comes back and they put on an actually good show.
Right. And even the bad show is happening in this sort of off space. Like you see a little bit of that running of the Bulls number, but it's mainly an excuse for Salma Hayek to do this brief cameo.
Right.
You don't really see the results of the lack of Kermit. You only just sort of know things are falling apart because you hear Constantine saying, I don't care about the show. Put on any show you want. And just something about that, like this Muppet saying, like, I don't care about showmanship. I don't know. It just seemed like a very flat – thing to keep on returning to over and over again.
That's fair.
All right, but you should say one last thing in Muppets Most Wanted Defense. Tell people why they should go see
it. Well, I mean, you know, I do think that you've made some good points about the I do think you've made some good points about the ways in which the creators of this movie have sort of forgotten some of the important elements of a great Muppet movie. That said, I do think that these people do understand what makes the Muppets great, and you know this is an opportunity to spend 2 hours in the company of these characters. I would like to have spent more time with Kermit. I would have liked them to do different things, but I feel like there are a series of funny jokes. You know, Waldorf and Statler get off some good cracks about how awful the Muppets are.
Another good gag. I'm sorry, just to jump in with one more, but the one that I was going to mention besides the Seventh Seal gag is when they go to Germany and there's a sign saying "Die Muppets,"
right?
And then isn't it Statler and Waldorf who say like, "I see the reviews have come out early.
Exactly.
Die Muppets."
Yeah, that was. That was a great Waldorf and Statler moment. So, like, there are those little, you know, you do get some of those classic Muppet moments that I think fans will thrill to. There just aren't quite enough, and they're not strung together as well as they have been in the past. But, like, not every Muppet movie from, you know, the Henson run was, like, a wire-to-wire success either. You know,
no, so
I've watched some of them recently, and, like, the original Muppet movie was great, but, you know, The Great Muppet Caper is like, it has some great moments and it has some not great moments.
Yeah, I make no argument for that. I mean, I guess what you're saying, which I can see some truth to, is a mediocre Muppet movie is better than no Muppet movie at all.
You said it better than I did, but yeah, that's exactly.
And I'll certainly be lining up for the next one, no question.
Yeah.
All right, John, thank you so much for joining me for Muppets Most Wanted.
It was my pleasure.
Come back and spoil again soon.
Will do.
Our producer is Chris Wade. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. To serve others in ways that promote human flourishing and create a ripple effect of transformation for generations to come. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.